Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot-button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly. Welcome to another edition of Cyber Law and Business Report, broadcasting live from the Internet Law Center here in downtown sunny Santa Monica. Please be seated. We're here in the heart of Silicon Beach, and today is the first day of Silicon Beach Fest. So thank you for joining us once again. Our guest today, you might even say we have multiple guests today. We have Dan Lyons, who's the author of the bestseller Disrupted, My Adventures in the Startup Bubble, which the Los Angeles Times has called the best book about Silicon Valley today. We also have a brilliant satirist who has written, became well known as Fake Steve Jobs and the author of The Secret Diary of Steve Jobs. And we kind of have a modern day Norman Ray, who is exposing kind of the ageism in the tech industry. And fortunately, given our budget, which it's all one person. It's Dan Lyons. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm really grateful. Thanks.
And so, and also I left out, he's also been a contributing screenwriter for the hit HBO show Silicon Valley. And we were just talking about that offline, some of the funny lines he's been able to get in. So thank you for joining us. As usual, our show notes are available at cyberlawradio.wordpress.com. And so you started your career in journalism and migrated your way into tech journalism. How did that happen?
Very early on in my career, I was sort of working as a general interest reporter and copy editor, and a friend of mine was working at a trade magazine, and he said, "Look, you know, you should come over here and work here. This is going to be big. This whole computer industry thing is going to be huge." This was in the 80s. And it seemed like a good idea to specialize in one area rather than just being a general interest reporter. So I started off then just writing about the computer industry.
And so then you landed at Forbes, was it?
Eventually, Forbes. Yeah. I got to Forbes, and I spent 10 years there as a tech reporter.
Where were you with the dot-com crash?
At Forbes. So I covered the whole boom and the crash for Forbes, which was a very, very cool place to be in the sense that we were always very skeptical about it, but also sort of celebrating and making a lot of money. I remember the first boom, all those companies spent a lot of their venture money buying ads on our awareness. So we really, all of us in the press did pretty well in the first boom, but first bubble, say. And then covering the crash was also interesting from Forbes, because you could just see how quickly it all collapsed. Yeah.
I mean, I was in-house at a company. At one point, it was one of the top game company sites in the web, speedyclick.com, and then just quickly imploded to nothing. But what was interesting, because you were talking in your book about what it was like to be at a magazine then. Mm. And you guys were living the good life. You're going to parties on Forbes yacht. And I mean, I remember Fast Company at that time. And that was like 100-page, that was like a thick book.
They all were. It was Red Herring. And
exactly.
What was the other one? There were three of them, I think. There was Red Herring.
Fast Company.
No, there was another startup magazine that just totally flamed out. Like, it went away, but it was as big as a phone book for a while. They were amazing. Yeah, it was an amazing boom.
And so I jumped forward in my head. I was at a LA Press Club Awards dinner, and the honoree was Arianna Huffington. And so this would be late 2000s, first decade of the millennial. And she said, "I'm not the reason you all are losing your jobs. because by now, at the end of the decade, we have all these newspapers going out of business. You know, that whole wave of folding. But looking back, who was more at risk by new media? Was it, do you think, newspapers or magazines?
Oh, boy. I don't know if you could say one. They both had it so bad. I don't know if you could say one had it worse than the other. But, newspapers got hit on the classified ad side,
right,
of Craigslist, and magazines got hit, I think, just by the drop out of those big, you know, multi-page ad packages that people used to buy. But in both places, you still see survivors, and the survivors, it's interesting, the ones that have survived kind of for the same reasons, in that they do something unique, especially like the New Yorker. I don't think the New Yorker makes a lot of money, but it survives and gets on because you just can't get what they do anywhere else. And
right,
the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, to some extent, are, I guess, somewhat similar situation. But yeah, I know. But magazines, we had it. Yeah, it was pretty rough.
And it seems that I think they had to go digital more than a newspaper did, just because. I think there's a certain residual base for newspapers, just because they have the local information that, you know, that people are going to consume either way. You know, the sports. You know, some people are going to buy this for the obituaries or whatever.
Yeah.
Whereas magazines aren't necessarily considered, I think, as essential to daily life. That's probably my guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we ran into. I went to Newsweek right after Forbes in 2008. And, yeah, I remember going there thinking, I'm a tech reporter. I cover this stuff. What am I thinking? Like, you know, who wants a Newsweek, right? Like a weekly magazine about the news when everything else is speeding up to not even daily but hourly. And then, yeah, so... But I really wanted to work there because I just thought it was such interesting and good people there, and I wanted to work with them. And it was.
Did you work in Washington or in Boston?
Actually, I worked from home in Boston, but the office was in New York. So I would go down to New York, say, 1 week out of the month.
And right now you're calling from Boston, right?
Yeah, I live in Boston still.
So looking at, for example, you talk about ageism in tech, and we'll get that in a minute, but you know, in journalism, to a certain extent, that's happening. I have a brother-in-law of mine that was editor of a bunch of Baltimore County weeklies, and you know, their manager quickly figured out that a guy in his 50s, you know, may be talented, may have a lot of resources, but a kid in his 20s, who's 30, is costs half as much.
And so
were you seeing that in the bigger institutions? You know, were older people being kind of pushed out for cheaper, younger journalists?
Yeah. Well, when I ended up getting let go at Newsweek, which was after Newsweek was sold and then sold again, so we were owned now by the Daily Beast and by IAC, so Barry Diller's internet company. When I got laid off, I think in the first round, what happened? Anyway, when I got laid off, my editor said to me, look, I think we just want to take your salary and hire 5 kids right out of college.
Wow.
And I said, I get that. I mean, it sort of makes sense. Because I had been hired in the old Newsweek with an old Newsweek print salary, and now we were
a digital company.
New people, and we're a digital company, and like why are we going to – and I think it took them a year or two to kind of go, oh, wait a minute, look at how much we're paying this guy up in Boston. Why are we – get out of here, you know? So
that is where the story starts in Disrupted. You're given the surprising news that your tenure at Newsweek has, that you've graduated from Newsweek. And in fact, they can't even tell you who it is that, whose decision it was to fire you.
Well, I think it was my friend, and she just didn't want to say it. So she said, oh, they have decided. blah, blah, blah.
The Donald Trump infamous day, or people say.
Many people are saying. I love that. I love that trope, by the way.
So you decide to make the move into going, you know, kind of jumping the line between what you reported and the actual companies. And you mentioned how you had worked with other reporters who actually had jumped in. One had jumped into Microsoft, for example, and had quite a successful career at it. And so what was your thinking in jumping into, a tech company?
Well, I was thinking that I looked around at my own industry and felt everybody's going out of business. And if I try to stay in journalism, it's just going to be more of the same. I don't see there's any big macro trend that says, oh, and just hang in and in 5 years, things are going to be great again.
Right.
So I've got to go do something else. And then I thought, well, I mean, look what's right in front of my face is I write about technology. I'm a technology journalist. I'm covering an industry that's booming. And my whole career, I've seen, you know, people get amazingly rich on these companies, you know, and regular people that I knew, you know. So I thought, well, why not? Why shouldn't I do that? And a lot of journalists were doing the same. They were, oddly enough, at the same time, a lot of tech companies were looking to hire journalists because they needed bloggers and they needed people who could write, so, or speech writers. So there was actually more demand. There was always some demand in tech companies or any company for former journalists because they, they could be speech writers or PR guys. But the larger demand now was that they were all building their own media operations. A lot of companies now operate their own sort of little media operations, so they need real journalists. So a lot of my friends were getting in companies. So
So you weren't just any random journalist. You actually had developed a name for yourself. Largely, not of course from your reporting, but you actually developed quite a bit of notoriety as someone other than yourself. Could you explain that?
Yeah, while I was at Forbes, I I had started a blog where I pretended to be Steve Jobs, just kind of as a practical joke. And I kind of thought, wouldn't it be funny if Steve Jobs had a blog? He's like the one guy I really would like to hear from. And it'd probably be, if he was really unvarnished, he'd probably be kind of, obnoxious. And mm-hmm. So you could have some fun with that. And this thing really took off. And it ended up having a pretty big audience. And people really responded to it. And it was in the days when blogs were still kind of a new thing, and there was this whole new, every week there'd be some new blog you'd hear about and everybody was checking out. So it was fun to like get on to a new platform that was taking off. And so I did that, and that actually became, I actually wrote a book in that character of fake. I created this character called Fake Steve Jobs, and I did a book. And then I developed a cable TV show that never got made, but sort of got partway down the. Yeah. Well, I worked with this. I sold it to a network, and then they never made the pilot. But so I sort of got dipped my toe in screenwriting because of it. So it was very like this little practical joke just grew and grew and grew and became this kind of cottage industry for me. And
it wasn't little within the tech community. In fact, people at Apple found it to be eerily prescient that you seem to nail it at times, and they thought, my God, the similarity is almost spooky. And
yeah,
what was the type of feedback you were getting from Apple?
Nothing official from Apple. Like, they never wrote to me, right? But I got to know some of them because later I had a job covering Apple. I didn't cover Apple at Forbes, so it was not really my beat, but later I was, and I think most of them thought it was funny. They got a kick out of it. And even the ones that, you know, occasionally I would be making fun of the lower level people, like the head of PR or whatever. And so I think that everybody sort of thought it was kind of funny. And you know, they got that it was just a joke. I wasn't trying to be super mean or anything.
We're going to take a break in a minute, but before, I just want to do a quick question. So the highlight for you must have been when at a convention featuring Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, Bill Gates takes the stage and says, "I'm not the fake Steve Jobs." What better validation was there than that?
I have to tell you, I was freaking out when that happened because I think yeah, at that point I was still anonymous. That's right. So I was, nobody knew who was doing it. That's the other thing. For the first year or so, there was this big mystery about like who's writing this, but I wasn't aware. I was always surprised when I find out somebody famous or whatever was reading it, but that was the big one. You know, Bill Gates came out and said, before we start talking, Steve, I just want to say I'm not fake Steve Jobs. And then Walt Mossberg asked the real Steve Jobs, "Do you know about this site?" And he was like, "Yes, I do. And do you like it?" And he was like, he kind of gritted his teeth. And he was like, "Oh, yes, I think it's funny sometimes." And
right. Well, what do you say? You can't say, "God damn it, it pisses me off," because then that would shoot up your readership, you know.
And it makes him look bad. So and it was very coached. That I'm sure he was just. And then they say, "Well, that guy's got a book coming out. Do you know about that? And do you think he'll read the book?" And Jobs was like, "No, I don't think I'll read the book." But I don't think he necessarily liked it. Although I've had Apple people tell me after the fact that. They were, you know, in some meeting, and Jobs was saying, "Oh my God! I don't know who's writing this, but it's kind of scary. I feel like the guy must be tapping my phone because that is how I feel about some issue, you know, that fake Steve would be ranting about." And I mean, you could kind of guess where Steve Jobs, what his opinion would be about things.
Well, we're gonna take a real commercial and then come back and talk again more with the real Dan Lyons after these messages. You're listening to CyberLaw Business Report.
Stay tuned for more of the CyberLaw and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
It's time to take your ad testing out of the Mesozoic era and into the Ezoic era. Ezoic is the world's first machine learning platform, creating tailored ad combinations to monetize your website. Our automated ad testing not only boosts ad income, but increases page views, improves bounce rate, and will impress the user experience. Start your 30-day free trial today at ezoic.com and join thousands of publishers who are already earning 60% more with Ezoic. That's ezoic.com. Ezoic, make your website smarter. Ezoic is a Google-certified publishing partner.
Is your website hacked? Is your website displaying error messages or loading slowly? Even if there are no signs of malicious activity, your site may still be compromised. Websites, like cars, require regular maintenance to perform at their best and not leave you stranded. At Fjorge, our website maintenance experts can help you assess which one of our maintenance plans will best support your needs. Visit fjorgedigital.com or call 612-877-3840 and get the support and protection your website and business deserve. That's fjorgedigital.com.
Are you paying too much for your paid advertising, or have you quit altogether because it seemed like a huge waste of money? Studies show that companies waste 25% of their PPC spend on average. The web marketing experts at WMETraining.com can show you how to make your AdWords account a lean, mean, converting machine. Whether you're just starting out or want to take your skills to the next level, we have a class for you. Contact the web marketing experts at WMETraining.com.
More refreshing talk radio on air and on demand 24/7. Only on Cranberry Radio. The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Here is Bennett Kelly.
Oh, you're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report. And we're back here with Dan Lyons. And that was a lame impersonation. But in any event, your book Disrupted has a number of stories in it that are parallel to each other. And there are two levels of disruption, it seems. The first is a disruption of your career with the opening chapter of What Happens in Newsweek. Then you go to a disruptor, this new innovative tech company. And then this is also kind of comical, Mike Judge type of send-up of this tech, this almost can't shoot straight tech company with its ridiculous phrases, such as, when someone's fired, it's a graduation. And then there's this kind of, but a more serious part of what is going on in this disruption within the company in terms of how you make numerous comparisons to, the sweatshops in textiles, and now you have these content mills. And what are the millennials, what are they getting for all everything they're giving up? And what are they in terms of, okay, I give you cookies and free juice, but, is that what you want to give everything up for? And so let's start with the first thing. You were a successful journalist, you're in your 50s, and all of a sudden, boom. The life that you had expected to live changed, inalterably. And there's no signs that life's it's going to be hard to get back to that in your industry. But you're not necessarily, there's nothing unique about that story, particularly in journalism. Whereas, our generation before us, that's not something that happened. When they were in their 50s, they were kind of an autopilot and just cruising for the next 20 years until their retirement.
I think you're right. And I also think that there was, it's an odd situation for people of my age. I'm in my 50s now. So, I entered the workforce in the last century with, I guess, what were last century expectations that was sort of based on the career or the work life that my father had, which was you go to work for one company and you spend your life there and you retire and with a gold watch and a pension and health care for life. And that kind of got blown up in midway through my career. And then certainly in 2008 when there was the real big crash, and the internet has contributed to that as well. And so there's like a new set of rules of engagement between employers and employees. And if you were 60 when everything blew up, you could just kind of take early retirement and slide out of the workforce. And if you were 22, you're coming in and this is just the way you expect things to be. But people in my age, I think, at least I know myself, I remember feeling just kind of like, wait a minute, who changed the rules? Who did everything, how did this happen and how do I adapt to that? How do I change in mid-career? Because I don't think employers really want to help. I don't think they're looking to help people, learn a new skill. They're just like, fine, we'll hire young kids, So, yeah, there's this sort of lost generation, and I'm a member of it that is it's kind of caught between these two worlds.
And that, I think, in a macro scale, I think we see that at play this year in the election. To a lot of extent, there are a lot of people who, in some shape or form, whether it was because of their 50s or because their industry segment is gone, that are disruptive. They're kind of the voter angst is maybe because they are disrupted by something going on in the economy of the world today.
I agree. And I think at both ends of this spectrum, so you look at Trump on the far right and then Bernie Sanders on the far left, in a way, they're fans are reacting to that what you just mentioned, right? That everything's changed, and they're kind of looking for someone to blame. I actually think the big blame is the internet itself. That the sort of nutgrap version of our time will be the internet was invented and everything blew up, right? And that, but there was more to it than that. There's globalization, as well as
right?
But yeah, I think. So people are upset about this, and they don't know who to blame. And so if you're on the Trump end of the spectrum, you have a certain set of villains. If you're on the Bernie Sanders end of the spectrum, you have another different set of villains. But yeah, I think that you're absolutely right, and that's actually what I'm trying to write about in my next book that I'm still trying to get together, is this idea that this phenomenon is bigger than just, you know, my little story of getting laid off and trying to reinvent myself. It's a generational story about a big shift in society and the world.
I mean, it's Disrupted, I think, is a very apt title for your book because of, you know, the kind of the dual meaning and the dual application. But in terms of, you know, just focusing on you and the segment you're talking about, it's interrupted. You know, your life all of a sudden just got interrupted, and now you're put on a different track. And all the rules have changed. And you had zero say in it. And I guess that's where the frustration comes. You know, I played by these rules, and I was all set to, you know, make it to the finish line, and you put me in a new game.
Yeah, and it's at a time when, in your 50s, when you're right, where, I mean, maybe you're coasting. I don't know, that's probably, you know, fair enough to some extent. But also where, in days gone by, that's when you were making the most money,
right,
and you're really socking it away in those last 10, 15 years of your career. Maybe your kid, in my case, I had young kids, but for most people, the kids are kind of grown up. So that was like the last 10 or 15 years where you had some sort of position of eminence in your organization, and but you didn't work maybe as hard as the young kids, but that's okay. You weren't there for that. You were there to, whatever, do other, you know, add value, right, in other ways. And that's, yeah, that gets taken away. And what was extra weird for me was that, you know, I'm a business journalist, so I'd spent all these years writing about disruption and, you know, covering these things where, like, oh, Sun Microsystems is getting blown up by this new rival and their whole market's going out and, you know, 10,000 people are getting laid off. And I would write about these things and never really give thought to the fact that, until I went through it myself, like, those 10,000 people are 10,000 people with a spouse and kids and, right, scrambling now to start over. And I think I had been a little glib as a journalist in covering these things and sort of saying, well, this is a good thing. This is how the economy grows and things change over and the old dies and the new rises. And it was different to be going through it.
So you do land well. You land.
I land, and I make a bad decision, though. I land, and I go to a startup.
HubSpot
in Boston.
Can you explain in two sentences what HubSpot does?
HubSpot makes software that's used by marketing departments inside big companies or by small business owners who need to do marketing for their little company, for their flower shop or plumbing business. And it's built around creating a blog and trying to drive traffic to your blog and then converting that traffic, those readers, into customers for whatever you're selling. So it's a set of tools, software tools, very easy to use, that, let's say the example of a flower shop. You and I had a flower shop. We could subscribe to HubSpot software over the internet for, I don't know, $500 a month. And we would use that to create a blog and send out email to anybody we had in our email database and try to get business so that when someone in our town looked up, I need to send flowers, we would show up at the top of the Google search results. That wasn't two sentences, I'm sorry. But essentially, it's software.
That was kind of the point.
Yeah, it's software that lets small businesses find customers.
So okay.
That's, using online tools like email and blogs.
I suspected that the answer was no, but it was interesting to hear it. But you go to HubSpot, and what was your expectation of what that would be like?
Well, it was. I thought it was going to be really cool, and I was going to learn a lot. For a couple, I knew it was going to be, you know, different than journalism. But the two founders were from MIT. I thought, oh, they're really smart, and I do think that marketing is being reinvented, and the way people buy and sell products online is changing, and I think they're onto something with this. So I kind of thought these guys are kind of hot. This is going to be cool. This is a cool company that's going to have a big IPO, and I'm going to be there for it. That's I kind of thought it was going to be a cool adventure.
And actually, an important point: they are a pre-IPO company. And one other important point is we use the word Silicon Valley, and you explain in your book that is not a geographic term. That is referring to this kind of whole tech disruptive type of environment, whether it's in Silicon Valley, Boston, Austin, Seattle, wherever.
Or L.A., where you are, Silicon Beach.
Silicon Beach. Although that's a unique subculture.
Is it?
Well, I mean, you get the whole L.A. flavor of it, you know, the kind of the dude part of it. But it is taking off. And actually, you know, as I mentioned at the start of the show, today is Silicon Beach Fest. And, you know, that started off as a small show, and it's actually now in its fifth year or sixth year. And, you know, the business here, Silicon Beach is taking off. In part, I think what's happening is what everyone predicted at the start of the internet: the integration of media. And, you know, so everyone is down here because of content and media, and that's what LA is. LA is a content town. But there's also Dollar Shave Club, that's not content. That's just great marketing, you know. And so, you know, that's not strictly the story. So you go, you're in Boston. Is the office in Boston?
Yeah, in Cambridge. Yeah,
Cambridge.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, there's certain parts of this that are just quite comical. Like you make a reference to the fact that you were reading a book on Scientology, and the you see certain parallels of cultism even.
Yeah, absolutely, and brainwashing and groupthink, and it started kind of freaking me out. Like I had never seen people who were so uncynical and so sort of believing of everything they were fed. And there was this idea that, you know, you try to motivate people by telling them how important our work is, and we're on this important mission to save the world and make the world a better place, and we're so lucky to be here, and we're so special. It was very evangelical. Very, very much like that. Felt very much like a religion.
And there's some weird things you talk about. And explain the fact that one of the founders would bring a teddy bear to meetings.
Yeah, Dharmesh Shah. He wrote a big article for LinkedIn about how he thought customers were so important, which is, you know, okay, duh. But and he would bring it. He'd started bringing a teddy bear to meetings and putting this teddy bear, he called it Molly. So he'd put her in the chair and with his management team, and they would have to have the teddy bear remind them all that they, no matter what decision they make, they had to think about the customer. They, you know, customer comes first. And I just thought that was, you know, hilarious, right? And crazy and kind of funny. I mean, if the boss did that and then wrote about it and was so happy about it, I thought, oh my God, everybody would be laughing at this guy behind his back. But nobody did. Like, the crazier thing than the teddy bear was that nobody out of these 500 people made fun of the teddy bear. Everybody thought, oh, that's really cool. Dharmesh is so innovative. I'm like, have I gone, you know, down the rabbit hole? Am I living in crazy land? Or then I start thinking, maybe I'm crazy. Maybe the whole world has changed and everybody brings a teddy bear now, and I'm the one who doesn't get it. I'm the old guy, you know?
Clean to your pet rock.
Clean to my pet rock, yeah? Or just, you know. It was one of these moments where I actually called a friend of mine and said, this guy, look, read this article and tell me, am I crazy? And he was like, no, you're not crazy. Get out of there. You know, they're nuts. Those people are nutty. But, you know, it was part of a larger thing, which is they just wanted to reinvent everything about businesses and companies, and they were going to change the way everything was done. And they were open to anything, which in a way is good. In a way, it's kind of a.
But there's also a sense of hubris about it. And I remember, I don't know if you must have heard this a thousand times and tried not to throw up an equal number of times, during the pre-dot-com crash, it's not the bottom line, it's the top line.
Yeah.
Hello? I mean, the rules of economics didn't change just because it's. Yeah, and this whole kind of sense of that internet utopianism, that, it's a new world, you don't understand the internet. And when the internet is really just a means of distribution, it's another channel.
Yeah, but this is somehow magical thinking that attaches to it that says, no, you can actually, you can go on forever and never make a profit, right?
Right.
That somehow that's possible. And but partly it is that the market is rewarding companies for top-line growth and not worrying about profits. Although now, and just in the past 6 months, you've seen this shift where people are now starting to sort of insist on profitability, and you see companies trying to either become profitable or show that they're cash flow positive, or they're getting closer to being profitable. They're profitable in one part of the world, you know. So I think there is some interest now in profits. But yeah, that's what I was seeing when I was there. It's like nobody is paying any attention to profitability. It's just grow as fast as you can.
Well, one person paying attention to profitability is our producer, and we're going to take a short break. We'll come back. We'll talk to more of Disrupted with Dan Lyons after these messages.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report at this brief recess for our sponsors.
Great websites today need expert web design and development and need to be e-commerce ready and mobile friendly. But building a marketable and profitable website can be an uphill climb. Ready to make your new website or replace your existing website? Think Orange as the new way to get in the black. Orange Hill Development works with Fortune 500 companies and offer the same top quality development service at a fraction of what other providers charge. Brands like Absolute, Carlsberg, and Nestlé trust Orange Hill Development. Find out why you should trust your website with Orange Hill. Contact Orange Hill for a consultation today at orangehilldevelopment.com.
All of your favorite webmasterradio.fm programs.
Affiliate Buzz. Next Gen Now.
CEO Coach. Cyber Law and Business Report.
Have found a new home. SEO Rockstars.
SEM Synergy.
Webcology.
SEO 101.
PPC Rockstars.
Purse Strings with Maria Retan.
All of your favorite webmasterradio.fm programs have found a new home. Cranberry Radio. Cranberry.fm.
A more refreshing kind of talk radio.
Cranberry Radio. Cranberry.fm.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Here is Bennett Kelly.
And we're back and we're talking to Dan Lyons. And before I jump in, I just want to give a great shout out to our good friend Brenda Christensen, who you know from our year-end Heroes and Zeros show. Brenda's the one who introduced us to Dan, so thank you again, Brenda. So we come to our final segment, and the big issue that seems to have really been resonated from your book is, and it comes a year after the whole Ellen Powell trial, where Silicon Valley was, in essence, was on trial for then its lack of diversity as to gender. But you just raise another issue. It's the ageism in Silicon Valley, but as well as its lack of diversity as a whole. And what is your impression there?
I think it's a really big problem. And in fact, I did a panel with Ellen Powell a month or so ago in Oakland about this, where I encountered what I think was bias on the axis of age. But when I looked around at HubSpot, I could see that there was also a problem with bias on race and even gender. And then it occurred to me, these things kind of all go hand in hand. And I guess I am taken aback because I want to believe that the tech industry really is progressive and trying to make the world a better place and really is committed to equality and, you know, sort of basic values that, but when you look at how they proceed from the startups to the big companies, they're really not doing that. And I find it very, very disturbing. And I don't think there's any hope of them changing. You know, it's very, very upsetting and disturbing the way tech companies are behaving.
And it, what type of reaction are you getting? Is the ageism? I gotta tell you, yeah, I'm just a year younger than you, and I go to trade shows, and you know, there is that kind of the frat party culture, and you know, it's a very young, predominantly male culture.
Yeah, there's this bro culture thing that's, I think it's kind of new in tech, and it's it is definitely. Definitely weird, and I don't know. You know, I don't know who decided that a frat house was the great model for how to build a company, but that's kind of what they have. You know, they have these guys who are kind of frat guys who now have this concept called culture fit, and they say, well, you know, we hire people that we want to go have a beer with after work. Like, it's really important that you fit in with the culture here. But I'm not sure if that's the best way to hire people based on who you want to have a beer with, and I think what it ends up creating is this lack of diversity because people hire people who remind them of themselves, and so right. White guys hire white guys, and yeah, it's an insidious thing, and
I guess you would get a culture, you kind of get a homogeneous culture in a way, you know, where most people's favorite quote is, "Did we give up after the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor," rather than, you know, anything else more sophisticated than that. Not that that's not a great quote, but
where did that come from?
That's from Bluto in Animal House.
Oh right, right. That's right. Yeah, he's trying to motivate the guys in Animal House. Do we give up?
Yeah. Then, you know, shut up. He's on a roll. And
yeah. Yeah.
And it's so, like, I mean, how does that change? I mean, is it my field that has to change? Does the law have to say, wait a minute? Or is it?
I think there is a law angle. I was also on that panel with Ellen Powell. There was a labor lawyer from the Bay Area. But her feeling was that, like, lawsuits don't work. I mean, there are laws, but it's just very hard to win any of those suits. So she had become, I think, almost jaded about the, or disappointed that in getting redressed that way. I mean, I think honestly that the people who run these companies aren't going to change unless they think they can make more money. It'll benefit them financially. I just don't think there's any. They'll pay lip service to diversity, but they won't really do anything unless they're forced to.
But that's the irony, because, okay, the one place where there are gray hairs, it would be with the VCs. And they're not telling them, hey, why don't you bring in some gray hairs to kind of, you know, tap their collective wisdom and steer you towards the next level. They're like, fine, you know, bro culture, well, yeah, invite me to the party.
Yeah, in fact, there was, there was a time, and I know I sound like Grandpa Simpson, but it was the standard practice for a long, long time that if you had a young founder, you paired him up with a gray hair, right? So Bill Gates and Paul Allen, they brought in a guy named John Shirley, who was the first, I think he was the CEO of Microsoft, or he was president, I forget what his title was, but he basically, right. He was a more experienced guy. And then at Apple, they paired Jobs up with, actually even before Scully, there were other grown-ups in there with him. And at Google even, John Doerr at Kleiner Perkins insisted that they get Eric Schmidt. And this was pretty much conventional wisdom. And in the last bubble, there's just been this change in which people are now seem to believe that the founders are better off being left to their own devices, you know, and you don't want to bring in adult supervision. Just let boys be boys. And I don't know who thought that. I guess they feel like the founders will chafe under the the control of a gray hair, or it actually may be that because there's so much money competing for deals now, the founders, the entrepreneurs, are in a much more powerful position than they've ever been before. So maybe that they can just drive that bargain and say, I'm not going to take your money if you're going to insist on me bringing in a grown-up. So
I'll go to this other incubator where, you know, we're having jacuzzi and tequila.
Yeah. And so they'll look around telling you
that.
But I mean, they have a lot more power. And so you have these, and I think maybe that sort of started with Zuckerberg, where he was smart. He brought in Sheryl Sandberg, but he also rigged things so that he controlled all the stock in the company. He could never be pushed out. But I think there is a sense that these young guys know what they're doing. We should just all get out of their way. And some do, I guess, but I'm not sure all of them do.
But is that the next disruption, the hubris wake up call when someone says, "Oh, you were right."
Well, we started to see some explosions. Like this company Zenefits had a big blow because they were out of control, and so you're starting to see some backlash. Again, I think it will be if the people who put up the money start getting hurt, then you'll see change, but not until and. Right now, the market is so irrational that, you know, things just kind of keep going on, and nobody's in any pain right now. So
we only have a few minutes left. So what's next for you?
I'm trying to write a book proposal, do another book, and maybe develop a TV show based on this book on Disrupted. About this stuff we've been talking about trying to reinvent yourself, and is that really possible? And what is it like when, you know, mom and dad get laid off and suddenly, you know, there are bills to pay and you have to sort of quote unquote reinvent yourself. So I think there could be a funny communist show in that or the world's most depressing TV show ever. I don't know which, maybe the latter, but or it might start off funny and then just get really, really depressed. That's what people say about the book. They're like, it's really funny, but then about halfway in, it gets serious, and then it's really kind of heavy. I'm like, yeah, sorry about that.
One of our first year, we were fortunate to have a high school classmate of mine who's an author, Bill Powers, who wrote Hamlet's Blackberry. And he's actually out your way. He moved out to the North Shore. He left the Washington Post and National Journal, moved out to the North Shore. And he disconnected, and he wrote a book about it. And it was kind of a big hit. And so I asked him, what was the reception in Silicon Valley? And it was shockingly great. Like, they were welcoming him in, and, you know, he was being brought in to talk to Google and Apple. They all wanted to hear this perspective. And I'm wondering, I'm suspecting you're not getting quite the same welcome, because you're not. It's not just a theoretical thing. You're actually, in some ways, naming names.
I am getting some invitations to come speak, but I think they don't want. No, I don't think anybody wants to bring you in and have you rant about diversity to them. Whereas, his thing. I'd love to meet him, by the way.
I'll do an intro
because I think people in Silicon Valley. That is like. It's so rare that they're offline that is now more valuable to them than anyone else. I remember reading a guy I know wrote this story about you could go on these weekend retreats in San Francisco where you had to give up all your electronics and just talk to people. And these kids would pay like huge amounts of money to go away and sleep in a tent and not have any not have any contact. Not have any electronics. It's like, dude, we call that camping, you know, in New England. We just, you know what I mean? You go up to the White Mountains and you can't get any signal on your phone. And anyway.
So we only got a minute left. where can people find you, and what would you like them to know before you leave?
Oh, please reach. I'm on Twitter at RealDanLyons, and I guess I hope they'll read the book and give it a try, you know, and maybe get a kick out of it. It's, you know, parts of it are pretty funny and it's entertaining, so I hope they'll check it out.
And so, Dan, and any appearances you want to plug in the minute we have left?
Oh, let me think. I'm going to London next week to promote the book there. So if anybody's listening from England, come to some of those events, I guess.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's been a pleasure having you. And check them out. The book is Disrupted. My Misadventure in the Startup Bubble. Dan Lyons, definitely read it. And as I said, the Los Angeles Times said it's the best book about Silicon Valley. Very quickly, as we're running out of time, check us out at the Internet Law Center. And as usual, follow us on our blog, cyberlawradio.wordpress, and on Twitter at cyberlawradio. Today's happy, it's Kobe Bryant Day in LA. Happy Kobe Bryant Day to you. And we'll see you next week. This is Bennett Kelly. Have a great day. And we'll see some of you at Silicon Beach Fest later today. Thanks for joining us. See you next week.
The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and their guests and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of Cranberry News Marketing and Cranberry.fm. Rebroadcasts or retransmission of this content without proper consent is prohibited.